You are listening to Faith is Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, a Q&A with special guest Aspiring Spike. We're talking approaches to brewing, the state of control in Modern, and how to improve as a Magic player. Then on a flashback, our testing results with Zombies and Sultai Reanimator. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faith is Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 79 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joining you from Minneapolis, and I am joined by the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Cave Dan Online, and he is Daniel Schriever in our hearts. Dan, what is going on?
Hey, David, I'm doing all right, but I think you skipped someone. Where's Damon Alexander?
You know, Damon is traveling, so during this election time, we had to bring on special guest host, newly crowned PTQ champion, Everett Mohan, known as Aspiring Spike. Welcome to the pod again, the host number two for you.
Hey, everybody. Glad to be back.
So just a reminder that Everett streams every day, Monday through Friday.
I do weekdays, Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Central Standard Time. And I try to do one tournament on the weekend, but that's a little more free form.
Excellent. Yeah. And then, of course, Aspiring Spike on Twitter, posting all kinds of cool deck lists, cool technology, shit memes, whatever you're into, you can find it there. So as people know, at the top of our pod, we have been encouraging people to vote for the last several weeks. We are recording this on Wednesday in the evening. The vote tallies are not yet finalized, but it is looking promising in Pennsylvania and too close to call in a few other states. So, gentlemen, any thoughts on the election?
Gosh. Well, I mean, we usually record on Tuesday nights. And since you were at the polls for what, like a 15-hour shift, was it, David?
Yeah, it was 15 hours.
Thank you for your service. That's, you know, there's a ton of pressure, I imagine. And there's a lot of honor in that civic duty. I don't know if I have enough time in this podcast to give all my thoughts on the election, but I'm ready to listen to this next week and, you know the results.
Yeah, it's been a sweat. These past 24 hours has been a sweat. And by the time this goes up, we, you know, we're hoping that it will be called. But then again, like, I don't know. I don't want to say that I'm hoping for that. I think I just hope that all the votes are counted and that we get some transparency and we figure out sort of what happened.
Yeah, and you guys, North Carolina and Texas respectively, were in states that were, you know, possible stretches as the Democrats tried to expand the map. And it turns out that maybe, although they did better in those states, they were still Republican leaning.
Well, North Carolina is still,
yeah, in the offing, as they say.
There was a part of me that thought there was a chance Texas would go blue, but most people I talked to and me personally didn't think it was too serious a chance.
Yeah,
it's just not quite there yet. You know, you had Beto lose by just a few percent 2 years ago. There's definitely a shift, but I feel like it's still years out. People, I think, were a little too optimistic.
Yeah, and I will say my experience at the polls was actually quite calming in terms of how the system works. There's all sorts of checks and double checks. There's multiple partisan people on both sides registering the count. There's like 10 or 15 signatures to move ballots or change any minor thing. So, you know, I think this sort of true American spirit, regardless of whatever your political leanings is, the people that can vote are allowed to vote. And votes are going to be counted accurately and fairly. Obviously, Minnesota may be an outlier. And I know we have the highest voting participation in the country, although maybe not this year because of how high it was all over the place. But very encouraging that that seemed to be the case. And there was no partisan wrangling or anything else like this. And we actually had a close Senate race. So it's not like it was, you know, not a place of interest. So I was very encouraged by that in terms of just sort of the American democratic tradition, the American experiment. And like Dan says, I mean, it looks promising if you're a Biden fan now. Hopefully it will be called for him by the time people are hearing this. But it does seem like all the votes are being allowed to count despite some protests and lawsuits and some other nonsense. And I think that's the most important thing.
Was this your first year being a volunteer?
Yeah, you know, my parents normally do it, but they both got COVID this year. They're recovered, so they could have done it, but it was just a kind of a reminder that it's not as safe an environment as we'd want for old people. So myself and a few other people kind of offered to sign up. I was sort of privileged in the sense that I'm not a registered partisan. Minneapolis, obviously, very Democrat leaning. So they want to have as many independent or Republican leaning people to balance out the primarily. Democrat leaning, other volunteers, workers, etc. So
interesting. Maybe that's why I didn't get a callback in Durham. I guess Durham was like 82% Democratic. So they didn't need me, or because I failed my driver's license test. I'm not sure. One of those two.
It is the case that people about my age, I'm in my late 30s, you know, I think we volunteered at the highest rate ever by like a rate of like 5 or 6X. And so I think a lot of urban places were kind of overwhelmed with more people than they needed. Even though the sites had more people, you know, we had a guy, his only job was just to hand the pens to people. And another guy was to collect used pens and start to wash them. So, you know, they had it set up. There was no dilly-dallying. It was this giant U. You were able to keep distance from people at all times and everyone was masked. So very impressive, very peaceful election for people in other countries worried that, you know, America's propensity for guns was going to lead to something ugly. So far, at least, it seems like it's just being debated on the internet, but that's unavoidable these days. So,
yeah, and I hope that will continue to be true by the time this episode goes out. But I don't know. I'm still nervous. I think that just this times that we've been living in, these years have taken their toll.
Well, we get some escapism in the form of Magic the Gathering conversation, I suppose.
Exactly. So we've spoken our piece on that. Hopefully this will be the last time we kind of have to talk about this election. On to more fun things. So first, some housekeeping at the top in the non-American experiment sense. We would like to thank our new patron, Jake T. Thank you very much for signing up. Just a reminder that patreon.com Faithless Brewing is where you can sign up for the Faithless Brewing Patreon. It gives you access to the Discord. And just a reminder that we also have faithlessbrewing.com. And there is a great new article by Stanislav. Dan, why don't you kind of walk us through his thesis statement here?
Yeah, so this, I guess, will have been a week out of date by the time you're hearing this episode. But it's an article from Stan, the co-host of The Dive Down, our sister podcast. This is an interesting sort of take on the modern metagame. So the thesis statement is that Heliod Company, the one that I sometimes mistakenly refer to as Scales, although it has no hardened scales anywhere to be found in this. This is Infinite Life with Spike Feeder or Infinite Damage with Walking Ballista and with Conclave Mentors. So Stanislav is saying that this is the deck to beat in Modern, and he has a nice assessment of sort of the strengths and weaknesses of that deck and some other top decks that he thinks are positioned to fight against it and how they might stack up with the tools that they have. Decks like Jund, decks like Red-Black Prowess with Death Shadow and Scourge of the Skyclaves, and Death and Taxes, as well as some other contenders that are maybe sort of a Dark Horse Tier 1, Forgotten Tier 1 decks that might still be good in this metagame. And based on the weekend challenges after this article came out, I mean, I think he got it pretty close to right, but I'm curious to know what you guys think about this.
I guess I have some, you know, kind of maybe nitpicky semantics about the title. Well, I just, whenever I think about the deck to beat, I don't think of a deck like Heliod Combo, which it seems like Stan's thesis statement is that Heliod Company Combo is well positioned this weekend. But it's not the deck to beat because it's not going to be showing up in big numbers in the tournaments, or at least, you know, this last weekend or next weekend. It's just not going to be the deck that you are going to be wanting to metagame a lot against or have a lot of sideboard cards for, because you're just not very likely to play against it. So I maybe just nitpicky. But
I mean, that's probably on me. As an editor, the responsibility to come up with a sufficiently clickbaity title falls on me. I think Stan would have preferred, you know, now is the time to play Green White Company or something. Mm-hmm.
And that does seem to be the thesis statement, which is why maybe I'm being too nitpicky here. I'm not 100% sure that I agree. I have played a lot against this deck, and I usually beat it. However, I'm usually playing matchups that are good against it, and I think I am possibly a little biased. I do think that it does have a good matchup against Red Black Scourge and decks like Humans, and I think that the players who play it think they have a good Uro matchup, but I don't know that I agree with that. the infinite life is not a lock against most Uro strategies. They usually have access to a Jace or a Teferi, and the Uro strategies can just grind you out of resources before, you know, before they can assemble their win condition that doesn't care about your life total. And I think the Ballista Heliod combo is pretty easy to disrupt. So I'm not sure that these decks are great against the Uro piles. I could be wrong, but that is my perception.
I'm thinking back to what you're saying about, is there a deck to beat? And would you say that, like, when you're playing on Magic Online, there kind of isn't really such a thing as, like, a deck to beat? My sense of the metagame is that it's just, like, too spread out. Maybe in the challenges, you can sort of guess what the top decks are going to be, but if you're just playing anything else, it's all over the place.
In my experience, and this has been true of Paper and Magic Online, the higher stakes the tournament, the better you're able to predict the metagame. And so, you know, when this article, I believe, was, you know, there are challenges this weekend. There was a PTQ last weekend. The higher the stakes, the more homogenized the meta is going to get. People want to be playing the best deck, what people perceive to be the best deck. But in league play, people are more often tuning, tweaking, brewing than they are in the bigger tournaments. And so, but in Modern right now, I don't think that there is one deck to beat. I think that there is a tier one, two different decks to beat, and those are Prowess variants. So there's a few different versions of those, and there are Uro/Omnath variants, and there are many different versions of these decks. And I think that those two decks are the tier one strategies that if you are playing a deck that's not them, you need to feel like you have a reasonable matchup against both. And then and there are lots of decks that meet those criteria. And if you look at the decks in the article, like the Eladarmis Toolbox deck, Humans, some Jund variants, Death and Taxes, I think all of these are reasonable against both Prowess variants and Uro piles. And that's kind of the Modern meta as I see it at the moment.
Yeah, I just want to give a quick shout out to the Eladarmis Toolbox. You know, I think this deck was sort of meme status when Fran started playing it. Obviously, he played a variant, and we even kind of couldn't figure out, like, he's playing four Ethervial in his Primeval Titan list. And it does seem like the choice to cut the Ethervials was maybe the right one as people have picked up this deck and iterated on it. But the core thing that he developed has become almost the way to do it. This deck seems like it has much better finishes now than Amulet. And Amulet itself was another deck that was sort of mocked and memed until people demanded a ban of Summer's Bloom. And then even after that, it was still a very good deck. So just a shout out, you know, people think the format is solved a lot of times, and a deck like this pops up and it's a meme until it's a deck that people just play. And it's just an accepted part. And we kind of forget that transition where we're like, oh, Modern settled or whatever settled. It's less like these cards all existed for quite a while. So obviously, Fran doesn't get all the credit. A lot of people, you know, iterate on this. They cut the Ethervials or whatever. And I don't know if he was inspired by someone, but just a really cool kind of history of how that deck came about from, you know, just a streamer, you know, kind of effing around, getting mad at Ethergust into, like, maybe, like Spike is saying, like a legitimate part of the metagame, something you have to be wary of. And you're going to see it at a high level tournament in Modern a reasonable amount of the time.
So by Fran, you're talking about F. Paulus MTG, the last Modern streamer.
The last Modern streamer.
Yeah, I've been facing this deck all the time now. And it's like you said, it was like, oh, yeah, that's right. The green-white Eladarmis Call Dryad deck. And it's weird just to sort of see that become like normalized. So, yeah, I just wanted to give a little plug here for this article. This is on faithisbrewing.com. This is our new content site. And a shout out to Stanislav. It's actually a fantastically written piece. You know, he's got a background in journalism, apart from his MTG co-hosting skills. And I think it really shows through here. So if you're interested, I'll put a link in the description. And as always, you know, the metagame continues to be dynamic and to evolve. So yeah, who knows what next week's deck to beat will be. Deck to play, I should say.
So just a real quick check-in with Mr. Spike here, since you play Modern every day. You know, we see you a lot of times with Islands, or I guess specifically in the case of the Boilless deck, a blue deck that does not play Islands. So what are you liking? I the decks I often see you playing are a like Jeskai build where you have the Rampant Growth sort of combo. You have the deck that you kind of, I don't want to say invented, but popularized, the
The Counterbalance Miracles.
Counterbalance
deck.
Miracles, and then
you can say invented.
Sure. <Yeah. laughs> and then the sort of Boilless, and then you're often playing some kind of combo with that. Basically, the new two-sided red blue land also seem to just really smooth out the mana for that deck. Often you're just chucking an Emrakul at your opponent, but it's again another sort of blue variant control list. So
yeah, Timu, who's another streamer, has been playing that mana base, but with the Kiki combo, and has been liking it a lot. And I've been kind of looking at that a little bit. Maybe Kiki Jiki Exarch is better than Through the Breach at the moment.
Okay. What are you liking between those other two decks that I mentioned? And I guess, you know, just Shark Blade as well as another deck that you help popularize.
You know, I think all the decks I've been playing recently are playable at the moment. Modern is actually, I think, very open. I think that there are established and good decks, but the metagame is so that if you have a good plan for all your matchups, you can really find success with almost anything. You know, I 5-0'd with Hardened Scales recently, and back-to-back 5-0s with Zombies. The format's very open, but if I had to pick one deck, it would be the Jeskai Flag Fire Control. In the last four streams with the deck, I was 13-2, then 14-1, then 12-3, then 11-4. Just, I've been crushing it with the Jeskai deck, and I've been really, really impressed by it. It's just kind of my pick for any big tournament at the moment, but I played Miracles today. I was 9-1 with that, and I think that Modern is definitely in a place where you can play the deck you like and do reasonably well with it, even if it's not the actual best choice for any given day.
I mean, those numbers are really impressive for the Jeskai Wildfire.
Yeah, I think the deck is great. I think the deck is really, really good.
Yeah, the one thing I would caution listeners on is, one thing I've noticed is you seem to have a very good matchup in terms of record against these sort of Omnath piles, and then I often hear you caution your viewers that the matchup looks tough, and to me it looks incredibly tough.
Yeah, the matchup is bad. I win the matchup more often than I lose it, and I think in like the last few weeks I'm something like 8-2 against Omnath decks. But I think if both players play perfectly, it does hedge towards the Omnath side. Not by a ton, but a little bit. I'd give it maybe between 3-5%. So I wouldn't, you know, expect to be able to just pick it up and beat the Omnath piles. I think after lots of testing, you could probably get to a point where you can be comfortable in the matchup. But if you're trying to play a deck to beat Omnath, that's not the one to choose. I also know that it does feel like there is a perception about Modern that these Omnath Uro piles are just the de facto best deck, and some people say people aren't playing them because they're so expensive, and I do think that that's true to an extent. However, I also think that if these Omnath decks were tier zero, if they were super duper dominant, you would see them more often, that people would, you know, they would pay the cost to play the decks and then make up that investment by winning a Magic Online, which can be very, very profitable if you have, you know, an 80% win rate. And I just don't think the Uro piles, I think they're a little overhyped. I actually think that in the Omnath variants, Uro is the worst threat. And because in the Omnath variants of the Uro decks, every single threat they play is incredibly, incredibly impactful on the board. They turn, they cast it. Rin and Six has to be answered. Teferi Time Raveler has to be answered. Omnath, Hour of Promise, Teferi, Hero of Dominaria. All of these cards have to be answered right away. Uro doesn't. Uro is a slow card. Uro is weak to... people have adjusted to play cards that are good against it. Lots of, like, Cling to Dust and Remands and Teferi Time Ravelers. And I think Uro is way better in like the three color control decks that are playing a lot of interaction and play Uro as a resilient win condition. I think that's where Uro really shines. But I would say that Uro is not the scary card out of those decks. I know that seems to be the perception. And because of that, I think that these decks are just kind of beatable by more traditional modern strategies.
Speaking of people playing cards that are good against that list, technology that I've seen you start to import into a lot of your decks that can tap for blue is Tail's End.
Yeah, I've been loving Tail's End. Tail's End, for those of you who don't know, it's a 2-mana counterspell, kind of. It's 1 in a blue, and it can...
conditional.
Yeah, conditional counterspell. It can counter 3 different things. It can counter an activated ability, a triggered ability, or a legendary spell, and that includes Planeswalkers. And it's the only 2-mana counterspell that, you know, is not... mana leak. that counters Renin 6, Teferi Time Raveler, Omnath, and Uro, and, you know, any other Planeswalkers they can play. Also counters Saheeli against the Copycat variants, and it counters the Felidar Guardian ETB trigger at the very least. It can also be a Stone Rain if your opponent cracks a fetch land. And when I was, you know, evaluating my sideboards, I was having a really hard time finding room for Ceremonious Rejection against the Tron decks, and then I was playing Dovin's Veto against, like, these Omnath piles, but now they play Omnath, and my vetoes aren't even that good, and I was playing some Mystical Disputes, but then those became dead in the late game. But Tails End has been really, really good, and what I really love about it is it's also good against the Tron decks, and so it just kind of replaces the Dovin vetoes and the rejections you would play anyways, while being really, really good against the Omnath piles, very good against Oops All Spells, because it counters the Balustrade Spy and Undercity Informer triggers. It's got applications against like Ad Nauseam, countering Lotus Blooms, Suspend Trigger. They're very good in opposing Blue Mirrors, sometimes bring in one or two against Taxes to counter like Ghost Quarter and Flick-A-Wisp return to play triggers. Just the card has really impressed me, and I think it's something you want to have in your toolbox if you're a blue player in Modern.
Yeah, you just answered the question I was going to pose, because I think we were playing some blue decks maybe a week or two ago, and I noticed that you've been incorporating Tails End, so I just added some to my sideboard. And I couldn't quite figure out, like, you know, when playing just Leagues, you play all these random decks, and I was like, am I supposed to bring in the Tails End here? And I had to do all this like mental checklist, like, all right, what is in their deck? Like, does this actually do anything? And I'm sure I missed a bunch, because like just hearing you say, oh, it counters Balustrade Spy, and I'm like, oh, I'm not sure I realized that in the moment.
Stopping Urien returns to play trigger is a thing that, you know, they get greedy, they blink their 3-mana Teferi, they kind of had you on lockdown, and all of a sudden you've...
That's something I think that came up in Standard a bit back... last Standard environment, just Tails End the return to play trigger on Urien.
Yeah, that's a nice bit of tech. I do want to ask you just briefly, while we're on the subject of the Omnath piles, what do you make of the Time Warp angle that some of those builds have incorporated?
I kind of think it's the worst one. I mean, it's not bad. None of them are bad. They all of the Omnath variants just choose one way to win the game. You can play the Copycat combo with Saheeli Rai and Felidar Guardian, or you can play a bunch of controlling spells, or you can play a bunch of Time Warps, or you can play Scapeshift. And I think Time Warp is the worst one, but it's not bad. It's just I think the other three versions are better.
Fair enough. But just to sort of reiterate, and this is a point that I've heard you make on your stream many times, Modern is a place where you really get rewarded for knowing your deck. So when Spike says things like he kind of understands what he's trying to do against these Omnath piles, it's repetition, it's the millions of matches. You also play very quickly, something I'm very jealous of. I'm still not very fast. And so, you know, you can play these decks that have not that many win conditions, and, you know, you can get into these grind fests, and often you're ahead on clock even when you're out walking your dog or whatever. But it's also just also that muscle memory of knowing to make the decision. Do I need to counter this or not? You know, you're not having to tank on a lot of these decisions because you already, like you say, kind of have a vision of how you want the game to play out. And that's helping you make these, you know, immediate decisions in a much narrower fashion. You don't have to consider all these extra options because you kind of know, what do I want turn 4 to look like? What do I want turn 6 to look like? So
yeah, that's something I talk about on my stream from time to time. If you're very comfortable in a matchup, if you've played it a million times, if you know what you're trying to do, a lot of the decisions you can make can be instinctual, reactive, and that way you're not using a lot of brain power, a lot of processing power on every small decision. And when you have something that's a little out of the norm, or you have a pathway decision point, you can kind of dedicate that brain power to the new thing. And so you get just a little bit better at playing the matchup every time you play it.
So we like to start each of our shows with a bit of a check-in on the state of the metagame. So we've heard a lot about Modern. This week, we did put it to our listeners to submit questions for Everett, and we got a bunch of great submissions. And so maybe if it's all right with you, Everett, we'll just go through some of the questions and hear a little bit more. We do have a question right off the bat from Grunkle Barlow. Shifting over to Pioneer, he says, how do you feel about the speed of Pioneer? Would you like to see it slower or faster? This is something that we've harped on at great length. We play a lot of Pioneer, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
So I did just win a Pioneer PTQ. I also haven't played Pioneer for like 3 months before that or after. and I will say that the PTQ environment is probably quite different from Leagues. fast versus slow is kind of, I view the format as being quite slow. There are, seem to be just a ton of different 4 and 5 color mid-range decks that play a ton of really resilient threats that gain a ton of life. And the fact that, you know, Omnath and Uro gain a ton of life makes it pretty hard in my mind for these aggro decks to speed up the format, which is one thing I don't like about Pioneer right now. And it's also part of the reason why I chose to play the mono-green Planeswalkers deck. You know, every land in there is untapped, and you can put threats into play faster than these slower decks and just kind of get ahead on board, take advantage of their tap lands in a way that the aggro decks can't. But I would like to see it faster. I think that I have not been enjoying the games I've played in the past in Pioneer, where I've been on the side of the 3-color midrange deck or the Reclamation deck, and I'm, you know, just slamming my threats into my Niv-Mizzet opponent's deck or their 3-color midrange deck. It's just very, very slow and grindy, and you just can, you just both have these engines churning, and eventually one player grinds the other out of resources, and those aren't really the games I enjoy playing. So I'd like to see it a little bit faster.
Is there any hope for that? I mean, what would have to happen for that to I mean, I'd love to see that too, but...
I think there is hope. I think that the banning of a either Omnath or Uro would go a long way. It's just the fact that the mid-range threats gain so much life, I think, is a big problem. So I think that could be pretty important for the general health of Pioneer. I could also see cards being printed into the format that are good against Omnath and Uro, and I think that's something we could maybe expect because, you know, Wizards did print these cards recently, and a lot of times they'll have hate cards for some of their marquee cards a set after they print them. So we just saw Omnath, and pretty often you'll see them let a powerful card take reign of a standard, and then they'll implement the counter to that. So I think that we could see some kind of card that's good against the life gain soon. I know there's that enchantment. Maybe that was the intention, but I think that there is hope. And, you know, I say these things as someone who's not super in tune with the format. I know the people I know that play Pioneer do like it. And I know I won a PTQ with a deck that most people were telling me was dead. And the deck seemed very powerful to me the whole tournament. Maybe I just ran hot. But it is possible that there is wiggle room in Pioneer that people don't know about, that the format could just adjust naturally.
It is interesting too, because like you say, the mono green deck that you sort of invented went away, and I never really understood why. And then another deck you don't see a lot of is mono red, and you met Cedric Phillips playing, I guess he's technically Boros, but a red Swift Spear deck with some Wizards synergies. And so two decks that we hadn't seen, and then they, you know, did very well in this tournament. So maybe that's a sign. What I've noticed is all these control decks are used to playing each other, so they're cutting Fatal Pushes. They're only playing 2-main deck or something like that.
And I found that the Niv-Mizzet decks were no longer playing Hour of Devastation, which was a card that was really, really important against Mono Green.
Yep, getting very cute with the 4-mana that you have their power to your toughness or whatever, and that does not get rid of your Planeswalkers. So I'm sure your Karns and Nissas were appreciating getting to survive the Wrath of God.
Yeah, for sure. I'm very hopeful for Pioneer. I feel like Pioneer was a great GP format, and if we ever see GPs again, which I expect that we will, I think, you know, when you get a lot of more good minds working on it for competitive Magic, that's kind of when you give people an incentive to play and work in tune, that's when I think we'll see some change.
Yeah, and I think for people who play it a lot, one thing that's comfortable about it is that the metagame is about 15 decks, 20 decks per deck dump, which, you know, depending on what you're used to, that's either really, really small compared to Modern, or it's like, you know, pretty decent, but not too huge. Some people feel like Modern is too random, too wide. Whereas if you have a 20 deck metagame like Pioneer, where there's like literally only 20 decks, you can actually make some headway on that, make some good tech calls like the Shadow's Verdict versus the Hour of Devastation or something like that. There's a lot of play to those matchups that you were describing, like there's the heavy weights going at each other. But, you know, it's not necessarily the most dynamic, exciting game you can play. All right, so much for Pioneer. Let's move on to some of these other questions. David, what else we have on the list here?
All right, so Craven DeBooty asks, how does someone attack the meta without a top-tier deck? He says, I know the concept of building around a deck, and maybe I'm being short-sighted or naive, but why don't we see new decks more often? Perhaps my MTG experience is tainted because I got back into the game in 2018, and all I've known has been power, referring to the fire design that's kind of dominated Magic the last few years. Are there just not that many powerful cards to build around in Pioneer or Modern? What do you think about that?
Well, I hope I come off as very humble when I say this, but my entire streaming career for the last year and a half has been brewing in Pioneer and Modern, and I think I've been successful doing it, and I am not the only person capable, I think, of finding success brewing in Modern and Pioneer. You know, I'm just a guy who thinks about Magic nonstop, and I think Modern and Pioneer are both wide open for brewing. It has been my experience in, you know, seeing most of the corners of the MTG world that most competitive players I know don't like to brew. They just like to pick up the best deck and learn it and master it and then figure out what the best deck is going forward. And so I think that that contributes to just the environment we have in competitive formats is that the best players don't like to brew. And so you don't have the best players brewing. And so I absolutely think that you can build decks. And I think the key to building a good deck is to find good cards that work well together and using them in a way that other people aren't. It's usually not going to be a brew that works out if you have a card that needs a lot of underpowered cards to make it work, to bring one card up to the power level of the rest of the format. That's kind of vague, but that's a tip, you know, that you could find in a fortune cookie.
Yeah, I think that that's an important point because someone asked me once, like, if we had a different approach than other brewers, or specifically you, because I think you're probably the most prominent successful brewer in what is not a huge field of brewers out there right now. And I was like, well, I guess there's a big difference of results. We do a lot worse than you. And our approach is like a card of the week where we are always just sort of like taking a card from a recent set. And then I like to think of it in terms of like, what do I have to surround this card with to let it be its best self, right? What do I need to, like, what is the card asking me to do? And how can I make it successful, make it one of the better cards in my deck? And oftentimes, like, if we just answered that question on paper, we'd realize right away that this is just going to be an underpowered deck. Like the card is too weird. You have to put all these weird pieces in to sort of show off what it's trying to do. And you end up with a flimsy deck. So I hear what you're saying. And I'm like, man, maybe that's the core of it. It's like, we're just not putting enough good cards in our deck. And then,
yeah, it sounds so basic, but I think we kind of found it, right? I started at a different point where all of the brews I make starts from a point of, I think this card or this interaction is specifically good in this metagame. And that's when I start brewing, is when I have that idea, this card is good right now, nobody's playing it, I'm going to take advantage of that. And instead of just saying, this card is cool, I like it, let's try to build around it. And I have done that, but it's so rare that that translates into a successful brew, in my experience. And so, and that's also why people ask me a lot to brew on stream. And I do on occasion, but I only ever brew and build decks when I get that inspiration, that idea. And it happens on stream sometimes, but it's just not something I've ever been able to force. It's just something that happens. I think a lot about Magic, but I think you just kind of have to maybe let it happen naturally, do a lot of thinking. Don't be afraid to try out your ideas when you have them too.
Yeah, and we have another question right here that you actually just answered beautifully from Lenny Huang, who was asking about, you know, it seems like Everett's consistently finding success with his brews. It's like he has a sixth sense for what's going to work before he jumps into testing. And what do you attribute that high rate of success to with your new brews? And what advice do you have to people who are looking to emulate your approach? And I feel like you've just answered that, but is there anything here in this question that you want to give this advice to aspiring brewers?
Well, one thing is, it does seem like I have a sixth sense for brews, but I think that's maybe a little overstated. I do a lot of brewing off stream, and so that way when you come to my stream and you see that I have an interesting deck title or something you've never seen before, you can feel somewhat confidently that I've tested it and that I think that it's good enough to bring to the stream. So a lot of people do see that I have a lot of new brews and decks, and they think that they just kind of come out instantly good. But in reality, I spend 3 hours a day testing decks, and most of them don't see the stream. And the ones that are good do see the stream.
It's sort of like Edison tried, 99 things before he got the right filament for the light bulb type of a situation.
It reminds me of something you said, Everett, the last time you were on our show. I think there was a question from our friend Brian Madden about sort of, how would you get into content? And he was worried, like, what if no one wants to hear about all his ideas? And I think you gave good advice there, too, which is that, when you have something that you feel like is ready to share and worth sharing that's going to add value for people, then share that. But don't feel like you need to just sort of share everything.
Yeah, I agree. I think if you have a voice in your head telling you to make content, I think you should analyze that and say, is this voice saying that I have specific things to say, the ideas I want to share? Or is this like, do I have a dream of being a content creator? And neither are, it's fine to have a dream to be a content creator. But if that's what you have, if it's just a dream, then at that point you need to figure out what you're going to say, And if you have an idea, if you just have ideas you want to share, I encourage you to just share them. And if you have reservations, I would just try to, slowly expand your comfort zone, take it a step at a time, stream a little bit, tweet out a little bit, make smaller videos, and slowly work your way up. It is kind of like a muscle that you exercise. You get more and more comfortable as you go.
So speaking of Brian Madden, we have a question from Brian, and I should also just add briefly that Brian must have thought about your question, your answer last time, and answered in the affirmative, because he's now the co-host of an excellent podcast called the Serum Visions Podcast, together with Mana Symbol and Jiggy Wiggy, a couple other brewers in the Modern Brewing family. So definitely, if you like this show, check out Serum Visions. But question for Everett here from Brian is, what pet card are you just waiting for the perfect synergy piece to be printed for?
I've got a couple. I think Witch's Cottage is going to be a card that sees like competitive modern play at some point. That's the black Mystic Sanctuary that puts a creature on top. I think that in order for that card to be good, Witch's Cottage, there's going to have to be some good black creatures in modern at some point. And right now, there's just not that many. But I think that's definitely a card to keep an eye out for. There's also a card I really like, Deathless Knight. I really want it to be good. It's a 4-mana, 4/2 haste. And whenever you gain life, you return it from your graveyard to your hand. And I really feel like there could be some kind of sack outlet that gains you life and mana printed at some point. To let you just like replay these Deathless Knights from your graveyard over and over again. And it also has, 4 devotion. The card's probably not very good, but it's a card I like a lot. And I'm hopeful I get to cast it in Modern one day.
So this is from Throne of Eldraine, right?
Yes, Throne of Eldraine, Deathless Knight, 4 green-black hybrid mana in the casting cost for a 4/2 haste. And whenever you gain life, you can return it from your graveyard to your hand.
Yeah, so when this card was previewed in Eldraine, it reminded me so much of Ovalchase Daredevil, which is another card that's like a 4-mana, 4/2 that you probably don't ever want to cast, but it does return to your hand from the graveyard for like a weird trigger condition. I think that one needs an artifact to come into play or something like that. And this one, I initially thought like, oh, this is another similar thing, but then I was sort of taken aback when it said you can only do this once a turn with a Deathless Knight. So it doesn't have the ability to like loop a bunch of times. I think it would have to be more incremental value.
Yeah, that's kind of how I've always thought about it. Just kind of some kind of like maybe smallpox smallpox deck, you're discarding it for value, you have some kind of sack outlet or discard outlet that's incidentally gaining you life and depriving your opponent of resources, and you pick it back up, you kill your opponent's planeswalker with it. I don't know,
peace of mind is not doing it for you.
What is peace of mind? Actually,
it's 1 in a white enchantment, white : discard a card from your hand, gain 3 life.
Oh, that sounds great. That's basically a Splinter Twin, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that also casts your Silver Smoke Ghouls for just 1 white per activation.
I mean, that is gain 3 life a turn, which is, I guess, not very good, but
it's like casting Earl without actually getting to attack with your 6/6.
Yeah, you can say that.
I mean, we're almost arriving at something. And I like, you can kill Planeswalkers with a Deathless Knight, like you said. So if haste is a good ability. Okay, so the follow-up question then, like, is this a way that you think about brewing? Like, do you kind of have, like, a backlog of cards in the back of your mind, like, oh, I'm just, I know this card has some skills, I'm just waiting for the right pieces to show up for it?
Kinda. I've got like cards that are always on my radar and cards that go on and off my radar. So kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the timeline for our podcast does not really let me, like, keep anything in the reservoir. We often go through the obvious sort of, like, cool brew targets after the first 5 or 6 weeks of a set. And then, you know, when we're kind of in the dregs, the formats aren't changing. We're waiting for the new set. And then Dan and Damon are like, well, could you brew something on this or that? I'm like, well, we could, but it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Yeah. Fair enough. I remember Jerry Thompson talking about, you know, he has like a little brewing notebook. I don't know if he still has that, but, you know, just something where all your ideas would just sort of collect in there. And I found that to be an effective way, at least, to just organize stray thoughts.
So sort of funny story about that. I don't know why this came to mind, but Paul McCartney and Elvis Costello once recorded a record together. And of course, Paul McCartney, one of the more naturally gifted musicians of sort of the post-World War II pop world. And so he didn't ever write anything down. He would just kind of sit down on a piano and write a melody or, you know, come up with some words. And he was like, well, you know, Elvis, do you have any ideas? And Elvis is like, ideas? And he has all these notebooks of like every conversation he had at a bar that was weird or any lady that said anything strange to him. He just wrote it down. And Paul McCartney's like, you know, trying to write Hey Jude over here. And Elvis Costello is just bringing out like tome after tome of like weird interactions he had in hotel lobbies. And so that's the Jerry Thompson way. Is he's more of an Elvis Costello than a Paul McCartney.
All right, so that's brewing. Very interesting approach and a very successful one. Let's shift gears and talk a little bit about control. So Everett, you are in some tellings of the tale, you got your start in control decks. I don't know, do you still consider that to be the case?
Well, my first ever deck was a green-white populate deck, an RTR Innistrad standard. I'd copy my Centaur tokens and I'd gain some life and it was a good time. So I'd say that's really where I got my main start. I eventually transitioned to playing Predator Ooze in the deck because my roommate played a Supreme Verdict deck and Predator Ooze had Indestructible. So I was brewing around Predator Ooze, you could say. But I would agree that a lot of my tournament finishes that people are familiar with have been with control decks. Actually, now that I think about it, yeah, three of my four PT qualifications have been with control decks, and now this most recent one is with mono green planeswalkers. So I do also think it's the archetype I'm the most proficient in, I suppose. But I like all kinds of magic, really.
So we have some questions here about playing control. Grixicism asks, could Counterbalance ever be competitive in a format without SDT? I've been trying to combine it with Hall of Heliod's Devotion, and it just feels right on the fringe of being good, but not quite there.
Well, I won a PTQ with Counterbalance. I actually played it today. I went 9-1 with the Blue-White Miracles deck. You know, Mystic Sanctuary makes Counterbalance really good. I take a look at your list, Grixis. It is an interesting idea. I think Hall of Helios Generosity is a bit too slow. Also, tapping for colorless mana is pretty tough with your counterbalance. But if you want counterbalance to be good, I've got a pretty good Miracles list that you can do some digging for.
So just a quick reminder, SDT is referring to Sensei's Divining Top. The card was is banned in Modern and is banned in Legacy. Legacy, I don't know if it's time or power reasons. Modern, I think it is just way too powerful for the format. Hall of Heliod's Generosity, just so people are aware. Legendary land, taps are colorless. And then one in a white, tap it, put target enchantment card from your graveyard on top of your library. So a way to manipulate the card that you reveal to counterbalance. Obviously, Spike's list has Omen of the Sea, everyone's favorite land, Mystic Sanctuary. Jace the Mind Sculptor. Am I forgetting any other ways you have?
Those are the main ones.
Yeah. I've been really impressed by the ability to sack the Omen.
Yeah.
That scry ability really comes in clutch many times.
Yeah, Omen of the Sea is one of my favorite magic cards these days. Just so good with like Teferi Time Raveler, Yorion, Counterbalance. Just love the card.
Yeah, I think that the idea of like using the Hall of Helios Generosity to control the top of your deck is a cool idea, but this might be a case where it's like, you don't need to combine that with counterbalance per se.
Yeah, definitely a cool idea, but I don't think it would be competitively viable, sadly.
Yeah, I saw you tweet maybe 3 weeks ago that, you know, there was a brief window for counterbalance again, because I think you said something like that the metagame was narrowing around maybe red-black prowess or something. Do you feel like that's a necessary condition for counterbalance, that you have to have some percentage where the blind trigger will still get something in, you know, a certain percentage of matchups of the metagame?
Yes and no. A counterbalance, I think, is a playable card in most formats, but they're just... it's... I find that Miracle struggles when specifically Greentron and Ponza and humans are popular. Just a kind of Aether Vial decks in general are pretty good against the Miracles deck. You know, basically, if spells are being cast and there's not a bunch of Cavern of Souls, and if the spells aren't really, really high CMCs, counterbalance is good. I think that, you know, with the curve I have, we've got, you know, a pretty good spread from 1 to 5. We even have 6 drops with Terminus, and, you know, you, the counterbalance doesn't need spells to be like super duper low CMC for it to be good. I've found, like, it's good against Jund, it's good against the Omnath Uropiles, it's really good against them. It mostly just shines when cards like Cavern of Souls and Aether Vial and like Karn Liberated aren't super popular. And I think that is the case to a large extent right now. Humans is kind of on the uptick, but you can maybe try to dodge it.
And you can always just get lucky and get your one mana wrath on humans early.
Yeah, I got very lucky today. Yeah. It's weird. It is definitely a control deck that you just have to get lucky with to some extent. Like, there are matchups that revolve around you hitting a Terminus in a timely spot. And if you do, you're going to win very easily. And if you don't, you're going to lose. And I think a lot of players, when they play a control deck, they want it to be way more consistent and way more, you know, decision oriented. And you do get to make a lot of decisions, but there's also just a lot of variance with the Miracles deck. And there are lots of decks that, you know, sacrifice consistency for power. And it's cool if this is a control deck that does that, but that's just something you have to accept if you're going to sleeve it up.
Definitely. So speaking of blue-white, we have another question from Weisford Ranger, and they ask, what is the current state of blue-white? As a lover of Stoneblade and his Sharkblade, is the list too slow for modern? Why isn't blue-white being seen more in the lists?
I think Sharkblade is fine at the moment. I have tried a couple different versions, one with a more blue-heavy mana base, playing a lot of Archmage's Charms and Mystic Sanctuaries, and a more white-heavy mana base, playing Skyclave Apparition and Castle Ardenvale. I think both are okay. I think the blue version is better with Archmage Charm and Mystic Sanctuary. But mostly, it's just, at the moment, it just feels like the Jeskai deck has more to offer. For me personally, and Miracles, I think, is also just a little bit better than Sharkblade at the moment. And it also seems that there's like this prevailing opinion that if you're playing a blue deck in Modern, you want to be playing an Uropile, and I don't really agree, but Stoneforge Mystic does not play very well with the card Uro, and it seems that people are kind of favoring Uro over Stoneforge Mystic.
So that was kind of going to be my follow-up question. It's not listed here, but you've obviously tried to maybe play like a Bant Stoneblade or something like that, and you haven't found the green to be worth it.
I've played one league of Bant Stoneblade. I 5-0'd, but I thought Uro was really bad in the deck. I think that Uro shines the most when Uro is your win condition and you're surrounding it with a lot of interaction. Uro and Stoneforge Mystic, I think, don't play very well together. I think Uro is not very good at holding equipment. Stoneforge Mystic also wants you to be surrounding it with cheap interaction and it being your source of card advantage. And the fact that your two like sources of advantage don't play well together, I think, is a really bad thing. Bant also has bad mana compared to, you know, Jeskai that gets a Triome, or, you know, Temur, which gets a Triome, or Sultai. So I just don't think you want to play the two together. I actually think Stoneforge Mystic is good against Uro. The swords it gets are both give protection from Uro, and then Feast and Famine gives protection from the zombies, and Maul of the Skyclaves can give flying over the zombies that gets generated by Field of the Dead. And I do think that Stoneblade is a playable deck right now. Its sideboard is tough because it plays so many counter spells that it just needs to be able to cut for creature matchups, and it's hard to have so many sideboard cards for those matchups while also being able to keep up in the grindy matchups. And that's something I've been struggling with when constructing my my Stoneblade, Sharkblade, Cyborgs.
So I know you're a big fan of Sharknado, the Shark Typhoon, but are there any circumstances or matchups where you're just like not happy to draw this card or to have it in your deck?
Yeah, I think the card is not great against the faster red aggro decks, but I think it's okay against the slower, like, black-red Jund Scourge decks. And I'll often cite it out in those matchups, but I think the card really does shine against combo, big mana, grindy matchups. And what's nice about it is the floor is just cycling it for 2 mana or pitching it to a force of negation. It's got a pretty low floor, or high floor, rather.
Even good against combo. Is that just because you're intending to hold your mana up on their turns?
Yeah. Holding up your mana for counterspells. I think at your opponent's end of turn, you get to replace the card and put a threat into play and just slowly kill your opponent with a shark while you're holding up counterspells.
That makes sense. So we have another tactical question here. This is from Odin's. The question is just 2+ or not 2+. I think specifically referring to Jace the Mind Sculptor here.
Well, hello, Odin's, who's a regular on the stream. I guess the joke is way funnier if you just explained it dryly, but
as all great jokes are
on the stream lately, I've been joking that Jace is a card you should always plus. It only has one mode, the +2, and it's kind of making fun of people who say the opposite, that Jace only has one mode, the Brainstorm. Why would you ever plus Jace? And I think that those kind of mantras, always Brainstorm with Jace, are okay for teaching new players how to use a card. But I see a lot of experienced players get into the mindset that they should always Brainstorm with Jace, never plus, when there are situations you should plus. There absolutely are situations you should plus. And modal cards are good because they have different modes. And so I have, every time I cast a Jace over the last couple of weeks, I'll say we're going to +2 here. Then I'll pretend like I misclicked on the Brainstorm and we'll have a laugh.
All right, one last question here. This one also comes from Wellsford Ranger. More of a sort of big picture question about the shape of control decks in Modern. So the question is, has the new card design turned control decks into creature decks, such as Mono White Taxes? Does the new card design force you to have a creature that also gives an effect? So we've talked about how these days, you know, if it's a playable creature, it probably casts a spell when it comes into play. So if so, is control an archetype that is just never going back to the draw, go, untap, and go decks? Should we be selling off our Cryptic Commands, etc.? You get the gist of the question here.
My answer to your question, Ranger, is yes. but not exactly creature, necessarily. I don't think in Modern you will ever again be able to play a deck of lands and spells and have one super dopey, like have man lands as a win condition or have Elixir of Immortality. That just will never be a thing in Modern again, if it ever was a thing. But instead of creatures, control decks don't have to play creatures. A lot of times it's going to be Planeswalkers or Shark Typhoon instead. You know, the idea how you play these control decks is you trade resources early, you get a card advantage engine into play, most commonly a Planeswalker, sometimes Uro, sometimes Omnath, sometimes, you know, just a Shark Typhoon being a 2-1, or sorry, a 2-for-1, and then you ride that card advantage to victory. So I don't think draw, go, control is going to be super good anytime soon in Modern, or maybe good again ever, but you shouldn't sell your Cryptic Commands, because Cryptic Commands are really good in these decks, and they're control will still exist, it just maybe not the exact version that you want it to.
I think it's also worth noting that Cryptic Command just sort of became playable recently, like in the post-Faithless Banning world. The joke used to be, right, people would play their tapped Colonnade, and then there are all these screenshots of, you know, Hogak and 6 other creatures in play, you know, pass back to you for turn 2. But, you know, now that Faithless Looting is not around, the format has slowed down a little bit, Force of Negation helps out, and maybe Celestial Colonnade isn't playable for a different reason, which is that Mystic Sanctuary is great.
I think it's that, but it's also these decks just need to be able to tap out for their 4-5 mana threats. Shark Typhoon 2 really hates tap lands. Like, it just wants you to have like all your lands untapped to sink as much mana into it as possible. But yeah, I think it's the Mystic Sanctuary is more of a factor into making Colonnade not playable.
But like you say, when you kind of put people to the test, do you have a big shark? Do you have Cryptic Command? They can't play around everything all the time. And And the fact that you can play your Crypto Command over and over again with Mystic Sanctuary obviously means you have this like full combo built in with basically no slots invested other than a slightly wonkier mana base.
Yeah, when I read this question and I saw like draw go decks in Modern, I was thinking of like Grixis Control, you know, Corey Burkhardt style with just Snapcasters and K commands and Cryptic commands and maybe like Search for Escanta or something. And I used to love playing those decks, but what I found was that like no matter how many things you counterspells and removal you put in the deck, like something's going to slip through and you need to be able to like let those things be on the table for a turn or two and not just lose to an unanswered threat like that. So I'm wondering, is as part of it just that like in the current era of fire design or where threats tend to just be snowballing things that accumulate advantage so quickly if they stay in play that you just like can't let things slip through anymore?
Yeah, that's well, I think it's just like why if you're going to be playing this controlling deck where you're answering everything one for one, why would you have your win condition be like just Snapcaster Beats or like the Tasigers that Burkhardt was playing when you have the ability to play these resilient and powerful card advantage engines yourself? You're just, I think, putting yourself at a disadvantage by doing so. And so I think you can win games still with these more traditional pure versions of control decks. They're just not as good anymore. And I don't think that's inherently a bad thing. And just like control has really good and resilient win conditions in the form of Uro, Jace, Teferi, Hero of Dominaria. And I don't think they really play out so differently from these like really old school hard control decks, you know? They just feel more consistent and maybe win faster even.
Just gotta learn to love the new face of control.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think you just either learn to love it or you play a different archetype or you find a different game to play. Or you just enjoy, or you just play the archetype you enjoy and say this is not the best way to build it, but this is what I like to play, and this is the card game I like, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Cryptic is great right now. Cryptic is great.
Yeah, so. It is. Yeah.
All right, so let's leave it there for a moment. We'll take a short break right now. When we come back, we will have our flashback segment talking about some of our spooky brews that we played in our Halloween episode, and maybe we'll hear a bit more from Everett with some more questions if we have time at the end. So stay with us.
Welcome back. So as people may remember, last week we sort of had a little theme based around Halloween, which was some spooky decks. I was really fascinated by the list that Everett had previously played to a 5-0 as part of his Dono Deck Thursdays. Just a reminder, you can donate to Everett and he will play your brew up and give you a few notes at the end. And he managed to 5-0 with the Zombies list, which had a really kind of wild sideboard, I thought. So I had proposed kind of dressing it up a little bit and playing it through, and Everett had the same idea, or did you have the same person donate to you, or what happened there?
I had the same person donate twice, and I actually 5-0'd back-to-back leagues with the Zombies deck. The first time, shout out to Antifa Lockhart, of course. The first time was with their 75, which was a more blue-based sideboard with like a bunch of Ceremonious Rejections and Aether Gusts, and for the second one, they told me I could just build it however I liked, and I ended up changing a few cards of the main deck, and then the sideboard, I just wanted to have discard spells instead of counter spells, and then, you know, answers for big mana, answers to the prowess decks, and some more removal as well. And I liked the sideboard. I'm sure it would change as time goes on. This is maybe something I should have mentioned earlier when we were talking about brews, but a sideboard is the hardest thing to build when you're building a new brew. You don't know what your bad matchups are exactly. You don't know exactly, you know, where you need to compensate in your sideboard, what your sideboard plans are going to be. So a more general sideboard like this mono black one I have with like 4 Thoughtseize, 3 Sphere, 3 Claw, 3 Engineer, 2 Thirst are how I'll build them at first. And I'm having trouble with zombies because I'm just 10-0 with the archetype, and I don't know what I need to sideboard for.
All right, so how good is this deck? I mean, you're undefeated.
I think that it is a playable deck in Modern. to the in the sense that you can have a, you know, you can go infinite on Magic Online with it, I'm sure, if you play it well enough and understand the deck well enough. Is this a deck that you probably want to take to a tournament? I don't think so. But it does feel like there is something here, and it does feel like it can probably even be improved upon. And I think that it has a really powerful, grindy, resilient card advantage engine with Undead Augur, which I think is the best card in the deck. Soul Diviner is really powerful with Giralf's Messenger and Aether Vial, and, you know, has synergy with Carrion Feeder as well. And, you know, it kind of plays like an Aristocrats deck where it has, you know, a lot of resilient threats that draw cards and amasses a big board state and has a lot of, you know, little damage triggers. And if you like Aristocrat style decks, I would recommend checking this out. So I think the deck is real and the deck is good, but I'm not sure if it's real good.
So in terms of the blue splash, you were playing 3 Soul Diviners, 4 Diagraph Captains in the first build, right? The Diagraph Captain is kind of like a double lord, if you are being generous, but the Soul Diviner seems like it has a totally different role, right? It's got like this weird, your entire 2 slot is dedicated to drawing cards, more or less. Or is Soul Diviner actually a little more versatile than that?
You could say that it's more versatile because it just makes your cards, it makes your Plague Belchers and Giralf's Messengers a little bit better because you're removing that Undying counter. You're removing the -1 counters that Plague Belcher makes. But it is a card advantage engine, and this deck plays like a kind of grindy Aristocrats deck, and Soul Diviner it has just been very, very powerful. It's a little bit better than tap, draw a card, because usually when you're removing a counter, you're making the Plague Belcher or the Giralf's Messenger a little bit better. And I've been very, very impressed with this deck's ability to just draw a ton of cards with Cryptbreaker, Undead Augur, Soul Diviner, and Aether Vial. Decks that get to draw cards tend to be able to have some really powerful starts and overcome a lot of things, and I just like the deck. I think the deck is a good way to build it.
I noticed that a couple other players that had success with this list, there was a 5-0 with I think a pretty similar blue-black version, and there was another 5-0 where a player named Tarak, sorry, apologies to them for butchering that name, had replaced a blue splash with a light white splash. They'd gone with 4 Tidehollow Scholars and then a Wayward Servant. This is the 2/2 for 2 that drains a life whenever another zombie enters the battlefield. So heavier on the 2 drops, you lose the card drawing power of the Soul Diviner and the Lord effect of the Diagraph Captain. I think this deck was playing Lord of the Undead in the 3 slot to get more lords instead. But in exchange, you get a little more disruption in the 2 slot. And just today, I thought maybe I'll just, you know, try this list out just to see, you know, maybe I can get some intel on like what this deck is soft against. But I don't know. I mean, I didn't lose either. I 5-0'd as well. So maybe zombies is just like invincible.
Yeah. I can't really articulate why it's winning so much, but it definitely is. This black-white version is interesting. I really like the Wayward Servant. In some ways, it feels like Wayward Servant is better than Diagraph Captain, and in some ways not. One thing I don't really like in the black-white list so much, though, is the Lord of the Undead. I think that card is just not very good. I think that card is worse than Plague Belcher in my evaluation. So if I was going to approach a black-white version over blue-black, I think I would probably play 4 Undead Augur for sure. I think you can never play 3 of that, but 4 Undead Augur, 4 Wayward Servant, cut all of these lords, and then that would allow you to play 2 Plague Belchers in this 3-drop slot, and then kind of have the Messengers and the Belchers be your 3-drop slot, and instead of having this, I think, really just not good card.
Yeah, I think there were actually 2 Plague Belchers. They're hiding behind these white-bordered Lord of the Undeads.
Yeah, I would just go up to 4, I think.
It was significantly better than Lord of the Undead, that's for sure. The matches raised questions for me. Like, I would see opening hands where, okay, my turn 1 would be a Gravecrawler. Turn 2, I could play like a 2/2, maybe a Undead Augur or something. And turn 3, I can play a Lord. And like, is this hand actually keepable in game 1? And my thought was like, I don't expect to actually win a match of Modern with this hand. Like, if it doesn't start with an Aether Vial, I just feel like you're not going to curve out anyone with a Zombies build. Is that Is that fair to say?
I definitely won a lot of games where I didn't Aether Vial on turn one, although a lot of those were Crypt Breaker on turn one. You know, I think you have a lot of good starts with like Carrion Feeder or Crypt Breaker or Aether Vial. I think that I agree that most Grave Crawler on turn one starts are a little anemic, but with Feeder, Crypt Breaker, or Vial, you can kind of get an engine going. And I think that's what this Zombies deck is about, getting an engine going, drawing a bunch of cards with like Grave Crawler, Carrion Feeder, Undead Augur, draining them for a bunch with Giraffe's Messenger and Plague Belcher and Diagraph Captain. And, you know, being resilient to removal is a big part of the deck as well.
Did you guys find that Village Rites was good? I mean, it's not a card we've seen a lot of play in Modern, obviously. It can be one mana draw two if you were going to, you know, want to put whatever card in the graveyard anyway. Obviously, in response to removal, it's fine. Is this a card that you think should be sticking around in these types of lists?
I liked it. I get a lot of Dono decks, and my chat loves Village Rites, and Village Rites has not been great, but it actually feels decent in this deck. It's like good with Messenger, good with Grave Crawler, good in response to removal spell. And the deck is kind of hungry for extra sac outlets beyond Carrion Feeder. I would play 8 Carrion Feeders if I could, probably. You can only play 4. So, and there's just not another good zombie sac outlet. And so Village Rites kind of gives you, you know, a sac outlet. You know, it's a one-time use, but it draws you 2 cards. And I think that is something that zombie decks want. And so if maybe there's something better out there, maybe something new gets printed, but I think right now it's good to play.
No interest in Viscerous Ear or Witch's Oven?
I mean, it's just not zombies, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe you could, maybe Witch's Oven sounds kind of nice to me. I like that card a lot. I mean, but then like Cauldron Familiar is really good with Oven and it's not a zombie. I don't know. I don't think so. I think Village Rites is the one you want, but there's some wiggle room for sure. And maybe there's something to test there. And maybe you could move away from a zombie sub theme, although the Undead Augur is so good. But you can maybe move away from a zombie sub theme if you just want like 8 1 mana sac outlets and play Cat and Oven.
Yeah, I found that, like, I mean, the Giraffe's Messenger gets so much more powerful when you have the ability to kill it. And, you know, Carrion Feeder is the best way. I didn't like Village Rites. Again, very small sample size. I didn't get that much use out of it, but the Plague Belcher was such a nice combo with the Messenger as well. Both modes, either to just kill it the first time, or if it has already died, you can reset it that way. It annihilates the counter.
And it's pretty often you get to cast the Messenger and then Vial in the Belcher. I've been pretty impressed by Plague Belcher. I was playing 3 in the blue-black version. I think that's like a good split with the Diagraph Captain. They can be bad in multiples, but I've been liking it.
And it has Menace, and nobody knows that, so you're just like watching them like moving around the blockers, like trying to... The game won't let them assign those blockers, and they can't figure out why. So it's a fun deck, for sure.
Did either of you guys ever consider a copy of Yawgmoth in this list?
I
mean, 4 mana is a lot for an aggro deck, of course.
So at least in the blue-black version, 4 mana is a lot, and you have a ton of card advantage engines already. It's possible that it's a good sideboard card, although maybe it's just not better than Plague Engineer against the decks with 1 toughness creatures. But, I mean, Yawgmoth is great, and it's very good with Messenger. Probably worth trying. Maybe in a different version. Maybe you could be mono-black. Maybe you could play Deathless Knight. I don't know.
I definitely considered it because you suggested that last week, David, but I decided to just like play something as close as possible to Everest list. Even this exact same sideboard, which must be copied from that original 5-0, just to get a sense of like how the deck worked. And yeah, I mean, the Augur, once it's going, it's almost like enough. And it also takes your life away at an alarming rate, especially if you have 2 in play. So something to consider. But yeah, I had a great time with this list too. If you're looking for a spooky modern deck and spirits don't feel spooky enough for you, I mean, Zombies is it for sure. So let's jump over to Pioneer. We had talked last week about an old favorite of yours, David, the Blood for Bones Reanimator deck, which no longer has to play Blood for Bones because we have the new offering Thwart the Grave. So do you want to just sort of recap sort of your thought process on this build?
Yeah, so the thing that kind of stuck out to me with Thwart the Grave is that the main target we had was a rogue. So we could really get back a rogue, the card that we wanted, and then something else if we wanted. The other thing I was thinking was I really got frustrated playing Jace Friend's Prodigy because he just died. And I wanted to go back to playing Champion of Wits anyway because it always loots. And one of the problems that I've had in Pioneer is the format is so bifurcated that, you know, you keep your hand with a bunch of fatal pushes. If you're playing an aggro deck, that's great. If you're playing, you know, the Urien, you know, Esper enchantments deck, the fatal pushes have no target. Or vice versa. You keep your hand with all these Thoughtseizes and you're playing mono red. And your hand's bad. So the automatic ability to loot from Champion of Wits both gives you reasonable outs to cast Thwart the Grave on turn 4. If you play a turn 2 Sylvan Caryatid, turn 3 Champion of Wits, you can cast your Thwart the Grave on turn 4. It also lets you kind of like filter through your deck. I'd found the sort of random milling effects not as powerful as I wanted if they didn't hit the kind of cards you want. You know, if they reveal a bunch of Thwart the Graves and not any creatures that you want, they don't actually fill up your grave for reanimation. So yeah, basically I wanted to kind of rebuild it anyway with more wizards. And then the fact that Null Priest of Oblivion is actually sort of a hidden reanimator spell that also can make Thwart the Grave cheaper because it is a cleric. There's just a bunch of synergies I wanted to try. And the real major upgrade to the deck, honestly, is getting to play the new pathway. It makes your mana a lot smoother. You take a lot less damage. You can play a lot less of the fast lands. So your mana is untapped on turn 4, 5, and 6. More often, and you're taking less damage from shock lands. So that just in general just smooths out the draws of the deck. So yeah, I had played it a couple times before I sort of proposed it on this list, and I think you took it out for the first league, Dan, and you kind of liked it.
I did. I mean, I started off with, you know, some mulligan trouble, and I think I lost a lot of my game ones, and I was like, man, what this is not working out. But then I looked back at my matches and I was like, oh yeah, actually I won. Like I did win those matches. Actually, it was just, I played against, I think, 4 control decks in a row. And I've been playing a bunch of Izzet Phoenix lately in Pioneer, as we've talked about the past few weeks. And that deck has such a hopeless matchup against control that I think mentally went to a dark place when I got paired against, you know, Niv twice and Sultai Reclamation and Omnath. But the more I played the games out, I was like, man, this deck actually has a lot of staying power in the late game, especially once, you know, we fixed the sideboard up a little bit, got the Notion Thieves into the main deck for games 2 and 3, got some extra discard outlets, and I think I went 4-1 in the league. Now, granted, I only played against one aggro deck that was Bant Spirits, and, you know, that's not the fastest of aggro decks, so I felt like this build was maybe cheating a little bit. It was a little bit hedged towards the bigger control decks. I don't know if that's what you were going for, David, when you put this list together.
It was, you know, because we're playing 4 Uro and we're flipping through our deck so fast, I felt like we could kind of punt away a few extra cards in terms of removal. We are only playing 3 Fatal Push. We are also maining a Cletus, which is a great card against aggro because it is a warrior. That matters both for reducing the cost of Thwart the Grave, or, you know, normally you play your Cletus out against your aggro deck. They probably find a way to kill it. You can bring it back. And we do have the one Yarok, which is also actually a great anti-aggro card if you can kind of get it out a turn ahead of time. So I felt like we could kind of punt on slots there, and especially the sideboard is loaded up to play control because there's just so many of them. You're probably having Urien revealed to you like 2 times a league, if not 3. And then I even played against decks that weren't revealing Urien and were still control decks. So the grind is real in Pioneer.
Yeah, that was definitely my experience playing the one Pioneer tournament.
So my impressions are based on a very small sample size. I mean, David, you had previously 4-1 twice with the builds. And so, you know, adding 5 more matches, I didn't want to make too many changes, but I didn't feel like some of the one-offs were doing as much as I hoped they would. Like Null Priest, Master of Winds, even Yarok. Like, I kind of just wanted more of the cards that I knew I could trust. Like, why not have the 4th Agent of Treachery, for example? And just like little tweaks like that, I might just like move the numbers around, like maybe just put the 4th Push and the 4th Agent in and maybe streamline it a little bit that way, or even move the Notion Thief to the main deck, because I feel like it has a lot of great matchups right now. Descended Mindbender was one that we were playing as a kind of speculative card out of the sideboard. It does have a great synergy with... Well, not synergy, but it lets you get something more out of your set of Wayfinders and your Champion of Wits. But on the other hand, if that's something you're trying to reanimate when you just like have Thwart the Grave and you have the option to get 2 creatures back, you're not really getting much for that. And I think just like straight up lost the game, where if that had been something with an ETB effect, I might have won the game instead. So I might like tighten the list a little bit. But again, maybe I'm just I need to play it some more. You did play it some more, David. So what do you think about it now?
Yeah, I played through another league and went 2-3. It was one of those leagues where, you know, you never draw your fatal pushes in the top 30 cards. And, you know, if you just had one of them, you could have bought the time to win. I will say that my thought process is in post-board games, I am assuming that they're going to attack my graveyard somewhat. So I'm not as worried about getting like full value out of Thirst for the Grave. The deck almost kind of turns into a ramp deck against other control shells. And I just think the natural curve of like Champion of Wits on 3, Descended Mindbender on 4 is just really good. If you get to resolve Athwart the Grave, the fact that this might be a possible target in your graveyard, I think is kind of a negligible negative. I'm expecting them to bring in, you know, Rest in Peace, Soul Guide Lantern, what have you. So I'm not concerned about that. I tend to agree with you. Null Priest of Oblivion has not impressed me that much. Master of Winds is also a pretty speculative card. I just kind of want another wizard in there. It was actually good against spirits. So just being a 1-4 flyer was actually pretty good. But yeah, I think there's a few cards to tighten up. And obviously you can kind of tweak out the build to be good or bad against various matchups. But there's something here. I think it requires some additional experimentation.
I know you said that Jace, Friend's Prodigy, is dying to removal a lot, but isn't he a wizard?
He is.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just play like two of him and cut some of the other stuff and just let him die. I mean, it's probably fine, honestly.
Yeah, and then, you know, it is a creature that's, you know, it's not too bad if it's like the second guy you're reanimating with Thwart the Grave, and then it can flash back to Thwart the Grave the next turn.
Yeah, the other thing is, like, I think I just got too in my own head, like, oh, it's like a deck where their fatal pushes are just worthless. Like, really going to kill you?
No, I do think that has a lot of value. I definitely see where you're coming with that. But, like, at least the Master of Winds and potentially even these Sylvan Caryatids, I'm not sure how much they're doing for you when you have Uro that's also ramping. And I feel like getting to 4 mana isn't, like, that important for the deck. Like going from 2 to 4 as opposed like 2 mana Satyr Wayfinder or Jace or Grisly Salvage into Uro into like Thwart the Grave on 5 mana or 6 mana the turn after. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I definitely think those lower spell slots are definitely worth fooling around with.
I mean, immune to Fatal Push or like resilient to it is a huge boon, so I'm not trying to discount that too much.
I wouldn't mind like going up a land. You know, the Sultai Delirium would play 23 land plus traverses, and this is just 23 lands where the Caryatids are doing that work.
It has four Satyrs and 4 Wayfinders, but I agree 24 is probably fine.
And I found myself like trimming a couple of Caryatids as well. Even though, like you're saying, David, it does become a ramp deck in certain matchups, you'll hit your land drops, I think. I was surprised I wasn't actually casting a Thwart that often, and when I was, it was hard to get two creatures back. I mean, Uro was usually like the first priority out of the graveyard, and then I liked Thwart as a concept, but I feel like if it were just like a card that just got back one creature, that would have been fine.
Yeah, I didn't post my screenshot, but I got to do the Thwart for 2 agents with a Yarok out against Omnath.
Wow.
And just went over the top of everything. It was so sweet. And then once I took their enchantment that makes cats, Yarok triggers on any permanent.
Oh, wow.
So then I played just like took all that, turned my agents into like 6/8s or whatever. Oh, man, it was sweet. Anyway, I think the shell has promise. I agree. I think you guys are proposing that there's a lot of changes here that can be made, and I obviously went through like 15 different iterations with the Blood for Bones list. So I do like the Thwart the Grave, though. I actually think the card felt really good. I was casting it for 4 or 5 mana, and I was getting a lot more than 4 or 5 mana worth out of it.
Yeah, I do think these party cards are kind of just underplayed across the board. A lot of them are really powerful, but have huge deck building costs. That it does feel like there may be some fringe strategies that can take advantage of them without, you know, the cost being so high.
See, Everett agrees with me. We should do a party week.
is that what he said?
That's word for word exactly what I said. Yeah. I mean, the demonic tutor that lets you cast, you know, whatever you tutor for is just absurd.
Thank you.
Yeah, that card is actually one of the best Magic cards ever printed, if you can make it work.
If.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, it's a huge if. But it's interesting. It's interesting for sure.
Don't encourage him, Everett. I'm gonna hear from him all week.
I've definitely worked on it and haven't been able to figure it out, but I bet somebody can.
I've got an acquisitions expert Forex analyst in this very show notes. No, we won't talk about that one, but all right.
There just have to be good one mana party members, and there's just not. Yeah.
All right, we'll have to resume this conversation during party week. Coming soon, I'm sure. So, David, I noticed you played another league with, I guess this is a somewhat spooky theme. It has Soul Diviners. It even has our favorite horror, Thing of the Ice.
Yeah, that's what kind of triggered it for me, is someone said, oh, Thing of the Ice is my favorite like Halloween card because it's a horror. I had played this list on a previous week to pretty good results, and Zach Ryle, Mana Symbol on Magic Online, had also played it, I think, to a couple of 4-1s. I found my league to actually be quite miserable for whatever reason. All my matches just took so long. You know, I was literally just going through all the counters on Maze Mind Tome after Maze Mind Tome. I timed out, my opponents timed out. I killed my opponent right before they timed out, or vice versa. So yeah, the main interaction here, just as a reminder, the Soul Diviner can remove counters from Maze Mind Tome. It can also remove counters from Thing in the Ice. And then we're playing 4 3-mana Planeswalkers that have extra loyalty lying around. I think going forward, just for my own sanity, I would try to add at least one other card that could win. I don't know if it'd be a 5-mana Planeswalker that can just be a clock, or like a Brazen Borrower or something. I mean,
I'll just put a Search for a Scatter in there. What else do you need?
You know, a Shark Tornado. I mean, something here. But I mean, there's just a ton of play in this list. You see a ton of your deck. And I mean, the major problem, of course, is you're playing a control deck, but you're still vulnerable to all the creature removal because you know half of your engine are these 2-mana creatures. So they die to Fatal Push. You know, Soul Diviner dies to Edict Effects or whatever else your opponent might be playing. If Thing in the Ice is good, then this deck is actually very good, I think. But Thing in the Ice is not good. It's not good against other Planeswalker lists. You know, the few times we got to play against, in this league, I didn't get to play against anybody where it really mattered. Even the red-black Pyromancer list doesn't care that much. Like, they just replay Kroxa from their hand and you discard a card.
This deck does seem good against mono-green Planeswalkers if that deck does end up seeing a resurgence.
Yeah, like when I played this several weeks or maybe even a month and a half ago or something, that was still a thing that you'd see in the leagues from time to time. But against these other Urien lists, it's just like you're slightly favored after board, but your game one matchup is just very mediocre because you're playing Fatal Pushes and Thing in the Ices, and you know they're playing 3-mana Teferi and all this kind of stuff.
All right, so maybe time to put this deck back on ice for a while, leave it on the shelf. Right. I do just want to give a quick shout out. I guess this is actually dipping back into the modern for one sec, but on the reanimation theme, there was a great write-up by Fluffy Wolf 2, a noted Red Prison player and streamer. Fluffy has also a bunch of like secondary brews that are not Red Prison that he's been working on just over time. And I guess he has kind of an iterative approach to brewing and will periodically post nice write-ups on the modern subreddit, explaining some of the evolution of his decks. And this one was one that I think on the 18th iteration, he said he finally got the 5-0. Did you guys see this list? It was like a Vesper Lark body double reanimator deck.
Yeah, I did see it. It's pretty cool. It's an interesting idea. Trying to use, you know, Vesper Lark as a 2-mana reanimation spell effectively. Or wait, is it 2-mana or 3-mana on the evoke on Vesper Lark?
2 to evoke, 3 to cast.
Yeah, which is powerful. You know, you get to go turn one, crab, and dump some cards in your yard. And, you know, if you can Vesper Lark the body double, you get to put a fatty into play, which is exciting. I haven't played with the deck. Do you think that this is consistent?
Consistent? No. I mean, I've seen people playing it since they made this post, and it looks, you know, it looks fun. Fun and interesting, which is not, you know, it's not too good. But I think it was just like a really cool... A, it's cool to see the write-up, and B, just like the way that the deck is just like asking interesting questions. And I think, you know, what is the cheapest reanimation spell in Modern? You might think, well, it's Goryeo's Vengeance, of course, we should play Griselbrand. But actually, I mean, Fluffy is saying, well, actually Vesper Lark can be the cheapest reanimation spell if you're willing to find an eligible creature, and body double, if you're really thinking outside the box, actually is a 0/0 in the graveyard that you can bring back and it becomes something huge. And the second cheap reanimation spell is Footsteps of the Goryeo, 3-mana sorcery that brings a creature back. doesn't give it haste, and then you have to sacrifice it at the end of the turn. So it's like, what's the point of that if you don't even get to attack with the creature? Well, it, you know, it turns out that actually synergizes great with death triggers, and I think the big find is that you can do this with Persist or even with Undying. So, you know, I think this deck was using Woodfall Primus and Ashen Rider. You can play Duralis Messenger if you want to do some kind of zombie crossover, but you should probably do Woodfall Primus. And even just like in terms of like how are you getting these cards into the graveyard, you know, Hedron Crab, like Everett said, is I think what Hedron Crab Search a Supplier to self mill yourself, or even like Collective Brutality, Mind Rake is in the deck as well. This is the one you can overload it. It's a Mind Rot for 3, but if you're willing to also discard 2 yourself, you can cast it for 2. So just a lot of cards you don't see that often in modern decks, but the cards themselves are eligible answers to like what is the best in class version of the following effects. And it's nice to see them all come together.
Yeah, and Footsteps of Goryeo functioning as a double Stone Rain on turn 3 is really interesting. I mean, it almost played like a prison deck. The fact that it wasn't that consistent after that happened, but it delayed the opponent enough that he could kind of, you know, find the next piece of his engine. Also worth noting, not only does Woodfall Primus blow up 2 lands, it sticks around as a 5/5 trample. And there aren't that many removal spells other than Path that really deal with it. Yeah, it was very interesting to watch these matches. I had not seen a Jin Gitaxias Core Auger in a long time.
It's also pretty nice that the Vesper Lark doesn't get Force of Negation, but a bunch of blue opponents will feel pretty comfortable sitting back on Force of Negation, and they won't be able to counter the Vesper Lark with that.
Yeah, I guess the one thing I wish is it had a little bit more of a transformation and not needing the graveyard so much.
I agree.
I think that graveyard hate is not like at a super premium. I mean, I don't think graveyard hate is like the best way to attack these Uro Omnath piles, but people have cards that affect the graveyard a little bit. And that's actually enough against this deck. They only need to take a few pieces. It'd be nice if there was some kind of juke you could put into play. I don't know how narrow that package could be.
I wonder if you could sideboard into a mill deck because you're already playing crab. I feel like crab is better than supplier, so I'm not sure why we're playing 3 crabs and 4 suppliers. But I wonder if you could just have like a 15-card mill sideboard plan. Maybe not, but...
Well, I mean, the one card you should 100% be cutting is the one Ransack the Lab. I don't believe in that card as...
I love Ransack the Lab. Modern.
I would be replacing that with my fourth Hedron Crab, I think. I kind of like the idea of turning into a mill deck, if that's possible.
I'm not sure. Like, so you've got 3 Ashen Riders, 4 Body Doubles, 1 Jingataxis, and 4 Woodfall Primus, which is... That's already... Is that's 15, right? Yeah, I think it's exactly 15 cards. And so you could maybe build a deck where you're not playing Stitcher Supplier. You could be playing, you know, like these other cards, like I guess not the Footsteps. And yeah, never mind. I don't think it works. I don't think it works with this configuration. I mean, you could leave in some amount of reanimation, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, like, just considering ideas, I don't know if it'd be mill, I don't know if, you know, if it'd be Planeswalkers, I don't know if it'd be something else, but just a way to kind of attack from a different angle. Because if they have a few pieces of graveyard hate, this deck really cannot cast any threat. A Rest in Peace Resolve, they have to draw one of their, like, 2 Disenchants or 4 Feed the Swarms. So you're having to bring in all these cards that are specifically reactive.
I think that Teferi Time Raveler would probably be better than Disenchant. Yeah. Just, you know, it balances most pieces of Graveyard Hate while also being really good against counter spells, which this deck seems soft to.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good swap, I think. I think that, you know, to the extent that there is any reanimation in Modern, the juke would be, like, Through the Breach, maybe? Or transforming into a ramp deck. And this deck can't really ramp because the creature payoffs are so weird and all over the place in terms of mana cost.
Right. So maybe it's not possible, but it's something I'd at least consider. But yeah, I think it's a super cool idea. And like you say, Dan, a lot of these cards are just cards you don't see. I had to like read Mind Rake. I don't know that I'd ever read it before. So
yeah. So cool list. Again, shout outs to Fluffy, and I thought that for a Halloween week, it was a successful foray into the world of spooky zombies and reanimation. Let's leave it there for the flashback. We'll just take a short break, and when we come back, we'll round out with just a couple more questions for Everett before we go. Stay with us.
Well, welcome back. We just have a few more questions for Spike before we're going to let him go and doom scroll on Twitter the various statistical models like the rest of us. So we have some questions about how to improve. Very famously, you have never called yourself established Spike. You're still always trying to be the best Magic player you can be. So this is kind of in that spirit. So Jack Lionheart asks, when do you think you learn the most while playing Magic? If you were to purely maximize for skill improvement, how would you spend your time differently? And then sort of related to that, Wells for Ranger is kind of wondering, how did Spike next level his play, especially a control player of some renown? Do you keep track of your results and analyze your matchups? Did you hire a coach? Or have you just been playing so long that you just kind of know what to expect from the deck across the table?
I think that these two questions are very good. They're definitely related. And I think that you become... The best way to improve as a Magic player is to play against people who are better than you and to play against the highest caliber player as possible. And so I personally feel like I learn the most right now when I'm playing a high stakes match and I'm playing against some of the best players in the world. Magic Online, you know, I really, really felt it when I was playing against Jabberwocky in the finals of the PTQ this last weekend. It just is a different experience, and these days it kind of feels like it's kind of few and far between, but that's when I feel like I'm learning. So if I was really trying to maximize my personal skill improvement, I would just be playing like prelims and every high stakes tournament I could. Because, you know, your skill is kind of like a sword, and it's going to get stronger based on what metal you scrape it up against, you know? And the harder the competition, the worse you're going to do, but the more you're going to improve. And as far as me, you know, improving as a player and, you know, getting skilled in the game, it's just a result of me playing a ton of Magic for the last 8 years and thinking about Magic every single day and getting to play against some of the best people in the world and learning. And I don't keep results of my matches or analyze them. I usually feel like that's a waste of time because of how quickly metagames change and how quickly decklists change. Like your data is just not relevant for very long. Just the environments that the decks are in just change so quickly that keeping a record has never felt very useful to me. But I'm a very intuitive player. It's something we've talked about also on stream lately. There are two types of players. There are intuitive players who just have to play a ton and learn matchups and get that instinct. And then there are very calculating players who I think are less rewarded for just playing a ton and learning and are more rewarded for thinking and analyzing and understanding. And, you know, I don't think anyone is completely one way or the other, but understanding which of those two sides, intuitive or calculating, which one you are is very important to improving and understanding, do you need to just jam a ton of games or do you need to spend your time sitting and thinking about the games? And I think that's a question everyone should ask themselves.
So listening to your answer, the improving in your skills as a Magic player, it sounds like you're mainly thinking in terms of once the match begins, making the best decisions, you know, turn after turn or sideboarding, that kind of thing. Is there a different component to it when you're thinking like the larger skill sets that a player needs to succeed? Deck selection or...
Deck selection is huge, and I think nobody's good at it. I think some people are okay, but I genuinely think the average Magic player, me included, are just terrible at deck selection. So I don't know if I necessarily even have, you know, good advice for that. It's kind of the same. It's just I learn by making mistakes over and over again and just slamming my head against the wall until I can figure it out. And I think that's true of most skills in Magic the Gathering, and it's true of most things in life for me. I just have to go head first, make mistakes, learn from my mistakes, and keep going. And I think understanding what kind of learner you are and understanding what your weaknesses are and where you need to improve, and understanding how your brain works is really important to figuring out how to improve. And I know that's a vague answer, but the reality is that there just aren't, you know, fortune cookie answers on how to, you know, get really good at a game. It's just a lot of work and understanding how you learn.
My impression of you is that you also enjoy the process. So when you lose, you don't seem to get too low. When you win, you don't seem to get too high. So do you think just enjoying what you're doing while you're, you know, slamming your head in the wall sounds painful, but, you know, you don't seem to get too miffed when your, you know, opponent, you know, draws a perfect card or has Tron on turn three. You just sort of, you know, chalk it up as like another little, you know, piece of experience in the memory bank, and you're kind of on to the next thing. Do you think just enjoying Magic a lot is also what's helped you improve?
Yeah, I think having fun in Magic is something that people don't talk about enough. It's probably something I don't talk about enough, but I have fun every time I play. I have a ton of fun every time I fire up the stream. And if I stopped having fun, I don't think I would play or stream anymore. And I think that that is also very important to, you know, managing burnout and not getting tilted or upset. Another big part of, you know, not getting upset or, you know, is, you know, I've lost tons of really high stake matches, and the nerves are kind of just grinded into dust at this point. So,
right. So
that's maybe a bit of what you're seeing there. But if you're having fun with the game, you're going to get upset less, and wins and losses don't matter very much if you just enjoy the competition and you try to play your best.
What about like consuming content or strategy? Do you watch other streamers or do you read articles?
Honestly, I do watch other streamers. And I watch some YouTube, but I don't read articles. I honestly very rarely even go on MTG Goldfish. I'm just kind of like in the trenches, playing Magic every day, talking to my chat, and kind of just doing my own thing, at least these days. That's just been my approach, is I just slam the head against the wall until I figure out, you know, what I'm doing right or what I'm doing wrong, and it's been working out.
I'm encouraged to hear you say that. You know, I think everyone, even if we live in like the same world of like being modern fans, sort of has like a different slate of content that they consume, like whether that's listening to podcasts or watching streamers or actually playing. I think for a lot of people, playing is like the smallest piece of the pie. Yeah, it's good to just sort of remember that, you know, the way that you do it doesn't have to be, you don't have to do everything. Hey, first of all, stick to what you enjoy and like what's fun. And also just like, if you start to find yourself, I'll speak from my own experience, like I was hearing a lot of the same things because I was listening to like three or four like modern podcasts. And I was like, wait a second, we're all just repeating each other, including our own podcast. Like we're all just like saying the same stuff because we heard other people say it. And I'm like, you know what, like just like get in the leagues and just play some games and we'll get more information that way.
Well, I think people are just too afraid to make mistakes, and like they're too afraid to like just fire up a league with their brew or try a strategy that they haven't tried before. But I don't think you should. I think you should just be willing to try things and fail and not be very results oriented and be in it for the long haul.
Do you ever like watch your old matches on replay?
Never. I don't know. I just keep moving forward. I think that that works for some people, just doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I found myself watching this Netflix series, The Queen's Gambit.
Yeah, I've been watching it too.
Yeah, I love that series. Just binged it in one day. And
I think there's a lot for like any Magic player to get out of. I haven't finished it, but it seems very relatable, a lot of aspects.
It reminded me that like there's this whole like chess content sphere, so I just like my free time now, I'm like going on YouTube and I found some people who just like analyze chess games, like walking through turn by turn, realize I don't hear that often in Magic. I mean, the way that Magic commentary often works for like the highest level events is more just like to entertain or to.
Well, the thing with chess is the format always stays the same, and you know, in Modern and Pioneer, it's just so difficult to analyze a single match because the tech or the matchup is often just not completely relevant even 1 week later. You know, things just change so quickly that evaluating a game or one match, if you just dwell too much on it, you're gonna get left behind. And that's why I like it so much, is because it's always changing and you can always, you know, there's always something new to look at. But it's very different from chess.
Chess having all information known is another thing too. You know, a lot of times what you'll hear a Magic player say is like, oh, I was playing around X. And then he didn't have it. It's like, well, so technically it was, you know, they had the wrong read. So all their plays make sense in the context of how they're explaining it. But in chess, it's like their rook is there. There's no faking that it is able to move on the various columns.
Well said. So I think that's ways to improve as a brewer, as a control player, or just a Magic player in general. So thanks you very much, Everett, for your time, for your insights. Always a pleasure to have you on, and we learn a lot every time you come on. So hopefully we'll have that party week soon and get you to crack coveted prize wide open for us.
Fingers crossed. Looking forward to it.
All right. We'll leave it there for this week. Gentlemen, bid you good night until the last vote is counted and cast.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, take care, everyone.
Everyone try to get some sleep.
And with that, we have reached the end of episode 79 of the Faith is Brewing podcast. Thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed this discussion of the fundamentals of brewing and becoming a better Magic player. Once again, a big thank you to Aspiring Spike for stopping by the show. And another big thank you to all of our patrons and supporters who make it possible for us to bring you this show every week. If you would like to support our efforts, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/faithisbrewing. Becoming a supporter does come with benefits such as Discord access, access to bonus content like our extended show notes, and the ability to submit questions for episodes like this one. We also have merchandise at the higher tiers, including Faithless Brewing playmats and custom tokens. Decklists from this episode can be found at our content hub, faithlessbrewing.com, along with strategy articles, bonus decklists, and more. That's all for this week. Stay safe and happy brewing!